Oi oi, it's your boy, state-sponsored anime appraiser Jack Slack, and it's the Jack Slack Weebcast for the weebs. How are we doing? It's the match is upon us. Which seems like that's exactly the sort of move you do to preempt dickheads in internet forums who, when you bring up a great kickboxing match or boxing match that's going on that weekend, they go, you called it a fight. It's not a fight. A fight is MMA. Can Floyd stop a double? Can tension stop a double? I'm sorry. But yes, the match 2022 is happening this weekend, along with a really good UFC event. They're not even competing because the UFC event's on the Saturday night. The match is, because Japan is weird, on a Sunday daytime. Or it will be a Sunday daytime for me. It will be croissant o'clock. And I will be working out how to steal it. I'm going to lead with the match and all the Japanese kickboxing bollocks because I want to. And because it's the boycast, so you opt in to me just talking nonsense. I don't have to stay on topic or anything here. This is my world. And, we'll talk about the UFC event later because it is a very good one. But the world of Japanese kickboxing is, for me personally, it's kind of like when I watch a really good anime movie. Because I don't watch a lot of anime, I get to enjoy the anime movie and I get to go, oh, don't the Japanese love their melodrama or their giant confessions of love by school-age children and whatnot. I'm not bored to death at that, you know, but like I would be if I watched anime all the time. When I go into Japanese kickboxing, because it's like boxing for me now. There's just a few fighters I follow, and if one of them loses to someone, I go, oh, might give them a watch. Or if people are really banging on about one guy, I'll go watch it. But I can't keep up with it and do all this shit in MMA as a job. But it's nice because when I watch it, it tends to be because I want to enjoy it, you know? But Japanese kickboxing is a weird old world. I just to give you a glimpse into how weird it is. Tenshin Nasukawa, who's the big star, is he the A-side? He's part of the massive matchup this weekend. It's Tenshin versus Takeru. His last fight, his dad was coaching his opponent. Why? Because J-Kick, drama. His dad apparently was like, oh, I don't like your style. It's too conservative nowadays. I'm going to coach your gym mate to fight you. It's just, yeah, and he was there in the corner on the night. It was proper strange. I mean, honestly, that I always think that shit in boxing, when something similar, not the same, but father-son teams are always falling out in boxing. But that shit gets dangerously close to a conflict of interest for my liking. But then you watch something like, Formula One Drive to Survive, and that lad, Tito, whoever it is, he owns like two teams plus a load of drivers who drive for different teams as manager. That place is just rife with conflicts of interest. But then I suppose we shouldn't be talking about like morality and organized crime when we're talking about a Sakakibara, promotion. The man who has basically killed two companies the same way, 20 years apart, with the same thing. He gets a TV deal with Fuji TV. He gets outed for having Yakuza connections. He loses the TV deal. He did it to Pride, and he's now done it to, he's done it to Ryzen. They've lost their Fuji TV deal. But they, you know, Fuji TV had the match penciled in to be on Fuji TV. And now they're showing like one of those shows with 10 stand-up comedians reacting to Western TV clips and going, oh, you know, in the little box in the corner. That's not racist. I've lived there. That's what their TV's like.
Bruh.
Son. But, you know, J-Kickboxing drama is hilarious. There was a lad called Yuta Kubo, who I'll probably bring up twice this episode, even though I find his style heinous. He's a very boring fighter. And he beat my favourite, Masaki Nohiri, who we're going to talk about later too, because he's on this card. And for a while, he was like the best guy in the world at that weight. But he married this model, and then the two of them just sniped at each other on Twitter or outed how bad their relationship was. They're just writing things like, Yuta Kubo would get drunk and be like, I think my wife's cheating on me. I wish my penis weren't so small and stuff like that. And they ended up divorcing. He was like, I'm retiring because I'm divorced and I also might kill myself. And it was just bizarre, these people playing out their stuff. And in between this, he was beating people in the ring. You know, he's kicking the shit out of people. And, you know, as much as his style allowed him to. And still, like, getting on the internet afterwards to be like, wow. In fact, one of the nastiest low blows I've ever seen was Yuta Kubo. I was there live, actually. He back-kicked Masaki Noiri straight in the cock. Looked agonizing. And then any weigh-in for a Japanese kickboxing event, especially Takeru ones, he's always getting into scuffles with people. It's just a load of lads, a load of Japanese lads with bleached blonde hair, looking twinky, looking twink-like, and getting into fights. And the fights tend to be pretty good. So Takeru versus Tenshin has been... It's a strange thing because Tenshin has been a baby forever, as in like a very young man forever. I believe he's 20... Hold on, I'm going to look this up. Yeah, man, he's still only 23. He's born in 1998. Disgusting. Meanwhile, Takeru is 30 and like the old man of this match, when really that's basically your athletic prime, you know, with modern sports science, nutrition, so on. But they've both been fighting forever. They've got almost 50 fights each. They're both obviously fantastic knockout artists, or have been. You know, the criticism of Tenshin lately by his own father is that he fights too safe. It's been quite a while that this match has been an obvious one on the table that people have been talking about. I was checking when I wrote about Takeru, and that was in 2018 at Vice. You know, I thought that was something I did on my own website, and it turns out I wrote it at Vice. So that dates that. And I think I wrote about Tenshin back at Fightland. So it's been a long time coming, this. And there have been a couple of occasions where people have been like, oh, New Year's Eve, definitely big announcement coming. And then the announcement will be for some shit like Shinya Aoki versus someone. Actually, no, he's been with one for a while, but it'll just not be that. So it was a huge deal when they got this together. And, you know, sadly, they've fucked the distribution because we're going to have to steal it, basically, to watch it. But Tenshin Nasukawa burst onto the scene with... I think the first time people started talking about him was after that fight against Wan Shilong, whose name I'm butchering, but you don't care. That was a back kick to the face in the first 40 seconds. And that was the year that Wan Shilong was Lumpini Stadium champion. But that was in Ryzen. He was already having good success there. They brought him into Ryzen. That's really sort of where the Tenshin stardom started. He was... Basically, him and Takeru have been doing similar things in, you know, beating good opponents impressively. But Tenshin has had the added bit of Ryzen desperately pushing him to an MMA crowd. He had a fight against Rod Tang in Ryze in 2018, which was razor thin. You know, everyone in the MMA knows Rod Tang now, actually. I just saw Rod Tang buy a house for his parents on Twitter today, which was fantastic. You know, that man deserves all the money in the world because he's fighting every weekend. Sometimes twice, and, you know, really giving his life for it. He's going to have a horrible, probably even middle age, not even old age. But the Rod Tang fight was crazy because it was basically that Tenshin's been this amazing banger. He's a southpaw. He likes the southpaw open side counter. So he likes to drop away from your right hand and throw his left hand across the top. He's also got a pretty good counter right hook that he catches people coming in with. Wicked fast left round kick to the body and head. And then the odd rolling thunder or spinning back fist or whatever. But one of the things you'll really notice, like even in his last fight against Kazani, which was a majority decision, but it probably should have been unanimous. But majority decision, he was fairly conservative, but you could still see he could move Kazani around like he was big brothering him. And when he hit Kazani, Kazani felt it. The thing about the Rod Tang fight was that Rod Tang didn't care. He's just taking the punches from this enormous hitter, square on the chin, calling him on for more. You know, some of Rod Tang's fights, I think it helps that in one, he hasn't fought an awful lot of big hitters, but they keep showing clips of him, like, hitting his own jaw and going, come on. But the ones against Tenshin, you genuinely sat up and went, sorry, what the fuck? And then after that, he fucked around in MMA for a bit. He did the Kyoji Horiguchi match. There was a lot of, you know, trying to make him look good. Went back to Rise. Yeah, he'd actually had a tough fight against Soa Kim, who, again, another Thai name that I'm mispronouncing, but he had a really hard time with him the first time, just because, and like the Rod Tang fight too, after the third round, these were five-round fights, after the third round, he looked awful. But he had a rematch with Soa Kim in 2019 and knocked him out. And since then, it's been mainly Japanese opponents, and I was reading an article about why his dad was in his opponent's corner for the Kazani fight, and in that article, basically Kazani got the fight because they said, who would you like to fight next? And Tenjin said, I'd like to fight some foreigners, but if it has to be a Japanese, I suppose Kazani deserves it. The other thing about Tenjin is that he's sort of had a foot out the door for a while because he's done basically what every kickboxer does at some point and said, I'm going to boxing. Problem was that, like, Ryzen was still desperate to promote him, and they put on these just bollocks boxing exhibitions. I mean, you can go to Tenjin's Wikipedia page, and how many people have six boxing exhibitions on their fucking, have a exhibition record, basically, except Floyd at this point, and God, we're going to get into that in a minute. We'll get into it now. Ryzen have just, in addition to fucking up the match and just letting Ryzen die on its ass, Sakaki Bara came out this week to be like, Floyd Mayweather's coming back and he's going to fight Mikuru Asakura, one of our stars and a big YouTube presence in Japan. He's going to have a boxing match with him. No one asked for this. No one gives a shit about this. In Japan, no one cares about Floyd Mayweather. Floyd Mayweather's found an idiot who's willing to pay him to do nothing for his business. But anyway, most recently, I mean, he did a three-person exhibition thing, which George Foreman did after he lost the world title in the Rumble in the Jungle. And he fought 5 men in one night. And Muhammad Ali was on commentary at ringside, shouting at the fighters to tie him up and lean on the ropes. And George Foreman couldn't knock out these bums, basically, that they lined up. It's hard to look good against three opponents, or, you know, any number of opponents in one night, if they're not also in, like, a tournament fighting other people. You're basically doing a shark tank. And he did look shit. You know, he fought Hideo Takoro, who is not a boxer at all. You know, he's an MMA fighter who grapples. And he looked bad against Takoro. And then his most recent one was an exhibition against Takanori Gomi, who is, Tenshin is like 125, 130 pounds. I believe this fight is being fought at like 60 kilos, which is about 130 pounds, if I'm doing my conversion right-ish. But Takanori Gomi fights at 155 pounds. It's a big difference. And it was a two-round exhibition, 3 minutes each. Like, why are they even advertising these things? It's just, yeah, so stupid. But basically, he's been teasing going to boxing for a while. Talk is, this is his last match in kickboxing. I suspect he will find that he isn't that good at boxing. What he has is a great eye for a counter, great power. But I don't know if it holds up over rounds. And especially, this fight is a three-rounder, which Takeru, I don't think, has ever been past the third round. But I think he's been booked for a five-rounder before, because I think K1 title fights are five rounds. But, you know, jump in and correct me if I'm wrong, because I have not been following this stuff closely for ages. But this, the match, Tenshin versus Takeru, is three-minute rounds, which to me seems absurd for the biggest kickboxing match of the generation. But given how bad Tenshin's looked, like, from the third round onwards in a lot of these fights, if he's made to work, I think a six-round boxing match is going to be hard work for him. Think of Conor McGregor. You know, you can have amazing pop in round one, but the thing about really good boxers is that they have a very economical punching style that carries through rounds. They're not throwing everything to take someone's head off, specifically because they know they've got to be there for six, seven, eight, nine more rounds. But if I'm laboring the point of the cardio, it's just something that's always been very noticeable in Tenshin, especially because he really does stall for time when he gets tired. And a lot of his work against Rod Tang, and even in the Kazani match, you could see it. I mean, he'd clearly been working on tying up, or at least using a collar tie or something like that to get off the ropes. He was physically moving Kazani around. But in the Rod Tang match especially, you could see his answer to Rod Tang closing in on him, which Rod Tang kept doing, was to run out the side door and or just try and bang out there. And once he started getting tired, he couldn't bang out there, and he couldn't really run out the side door quick enough to not get kicked on the way out. And he was just sort of like left floundering whenever he hit the ropes. But to jump to Takeru, you know, he's... I don't think anyone would ever call him defensively even sensible, let alone flawless, his fights are wild. You know, I'm sure that I haven't kept up with what Thai supremacists are saying about Japanese kickboxing, but I am sure they're going on about how defensively porous they all are. Because this generation of Japanese kickboxers, they just, it's a buzzsaw of activity in every fight. And I suppose that's the advantage of having the three-minute rounds. It's a sprint. But Takeru, I think he's won belts at three weights in K1, which is interesting because K1's, like, the weight classes are much less far apart now than back in the days. I mean, K1 Max was the lower divisions back in the day. But back in the day, K1 just had a open heavyweight division, and then they added a heavyweight division and called everything else above it super heavyweight to get a belt on Kotaro, who also went to boxing. But man, if you watch Takeru's last one against Leona Pettis, that is, it's just, I mean, he's had some really good ones. His fight against Petchdam in 2020 might have been his fight with Yodkitsada in 2019. Yeah, he had one against the Thai where he just double low kicked him over and over again with the lead leg. He'd step up into a lead leg low kick, and then the guy would check it, and he'd throw another one immediately after as the leg was coming down. It was really cool. But the one against Pettis is crazy, because Pettis is a good bit taller and longer than him, and Takeru's throwing these kicks. He's doing a lot of leading with kicks and just throwing hard low kicks out of the open, and Pettis is standing there and just punching him while he's doing it. And I was watching the Kazani Tenshin fight, and Tenshin's literally doing that to Kazani. He's just standing there, taking the low kick and punching him down the middle. So yeah, I mean, I was looking at that and going, ooh, this could not be good for Takeru. But that Pettis fight, he's just going in and trading with him in flurries. He's getting clipped with the left hand constantly, which is just, I'm going, isn't that Tenshin's one move, his big move, counter left hands? But Takeru works so well in combination, so fast. He can take an amazing shot, and his left hook is unbelievably money. When you look at him, he looks like, you know, he looks like he could be knocked down by a strong breeze, but he cracks. And that Pettis fight is just so crazy, because he chins Pettis at the end of the first round, and the ref lets Pettis go. He lets him continue, because Japanese refs love blood, firstly, but because it's the end of the round too, he gets to go back to his corner and wake himself up a bit. They come out for the second round. They get into a trade. Pettis' left hook knocks Takeru down to a knee. He bounces up quick enough that the ref doesn't notice, knocks Pettis down to a knee, and then the ref jumps in and counts for Pettis. And then they come in for an exchange, and Takeru knocks him down with the right hand and throws the left hook, and Pettis crumples underneath the left hook that's coming after it. And Takeru throws the punch with so much force that he throws himself all the way around. It's just crazy. But one of the things I really like about Takeru is his lead leg kicking game. If you watch his K1 Grand Prix runs, he basically emulated Semi Schilt, who's the best K1 Grand Prix fighter of all time, statistically. So not a bad thing to steal from. But where Schilt was step up front kick and then jab with the lead hand and back off, Takeru is step up front kick, fall down into range, let the front kick drop in front of the opponent, step in and swing hands. It's a really weird style that you're using a very long point fighting weapon to enter with infighting combinations, essentially, you know, as close to infighting as you'll get in kickboxing. So talking of game plans, I mean, Tenshin Nasukawa, you want to land the counter left hand. The more he can get Takeru to stand on the outside and kick with him, I think the more opportunity he has to put the left straight down the center or catch him with the right hook while he's on one leg if he steps up for the outside low kick. You know, stand on the outside, hammer him with left kicks to the body and arm or head, and punch him when he kicks back. Don't worry about checking a thing would be my advice. For Takeru, I'd want to get to the body early and often, because that's how you're going to tire out tension. He does take a decent shot unless you're Floyd Mayweather and you've paid him to go down. I'm not going to say that. I don't actually believe that. I just love saying dumb shit to get people angry. But it's interesting, because I think Takeru will either live or die doing what he does. I don't think it's a case of he'll adopt a smarter game plan. I think he'll just go forward. Even if he tries to fight smart, he'll get hit in the head and then they'll trade. And we'll get to see where the Tenshin Nasukawa can stand up to 9 minutes of trading with Takeru, or if Takeru gets dropped and knocked out. I believe the only time he's been knocked out was by... Oh, for some reason in my mind, he'd been knocked out by Tiger, but it was him that knocked Tiger out with the spinning back fist. But anyway, for 9 minutes, it's going to bang, or at least until one of them gets knocked out. Can't recommend watching that enough. Don't know how to recommend to do that legally. So we're all going to wait on Sunday afternoon for someone to post it. It's like, is it Gabe Newell always said that piracy is a distribution issue? I would pay for this, and they're not letting me. But other good stuff on this card, they've actually done a really good job. It's done, I think it's sort of a Rise versus K1 card, but you got some good kickboxers who even I know on here. You got Masaki Noiri, who I've said before is possibly my favourite striker in any combat sport of all time. I think he's got just absolutely... He's not very good... he works well enough defensively, but his defence is to cover up with both gloves and walk forward. Offensively, absolutely beautiful. He's got this weirdo, Sato Keikan style of kickboxing, or rather karate as his background. But amazing body shots, beautiful knees, knees thrown from bizarro angles, great front kicks and triangle kicks. In fact, his rival at the moment, Rukia Anpo, is also on this card, and Anpo's a great guy to check out. He's absolutely gigantic. They're both about 65, 70 kilos. About 150 pounds. But Anpo's like 6 feet tall. And I don't think I've ever seen anyone score as many knockdowns with the jumping switch kick. You know where you kick one leg to the thigh and then you jump into a high kick with the other leg? Machida used to do it from time to time. Probably, yeah, you don't see too many people get dropped by it. I've seen Anpo drop about three different people with it. And he's just, yeah, really tall and really long. Like, when he blasts dudes, it looks like they don't expect his limbs to reach as far as they do. But both of them were in the K1 Welterweight Grand Prix in tail end of last year. Both of them ended up in the final having knocked out all their opponents. And Noiri did him. Absolutely beautiful work. He knocked him down with body shots, and then he stood up and he knocked him down with a front kick to the body, and then... Let him, you know, once he got up again, he walked across the ring like he was going to front kick the body, and then he turned it into a little diagonal front kick, a Sankakugeri triangle kick, and dropped him again. You know, just the man is such a great body hitter. And I've already said, amazing knees. Like, he'll jump up and bring his knee in from the side, you know, like a curved knee on the bag, but he'll do it in the air. He was having a hard time with Liam Harrison back in Glory 8. I think that was the same one that he got dick kicked by Yuta Kubo. But he was having a hard time with him. One knee sliced Liam Harrison wide open. Fight called due to cuts. I was watching him in a fight a little while ago, and this wouldn't have even blipped up on anyone's radar because it's not even a highlight of the fight. But he did a step up left knee to the opponent's right thigh. He just, from distance, he just stepped up and kneed him in the thigh. It's mad how creative this lad is. Lots of other people I don't really know that well on this card. Kento Haraguchi, I've heard things about him. Noiri's opponent, Kaito Ono, is supposed to be good. There's a guy called Your Man, which is like the next... It's my Pokemon evolution from Your Boy. There's a guy called Noah Bay. Sadly, B-E-Y, not B-A-E. But yeah, looks absolutely banging. We'll all steal it, I'm sure. So what we got going on in the UFC this weekend? A really surprisingly good card. I think this card on paper is better than the last week's card. Instantly, because it doesn't have a Valentina Shevchenko title defense on. But the main event is Calvin Kattar versus Josh Emmett. Featherweight, such a weird division. Because bantamweight, we all know. You throw the bantamweight names in a hat, pull out two, you've got a guaranteed banger. Featherweight's kind of like that, except there's this weird situation where a lot of the top featherweights haven't been able to fight each other very much. In terms of activity, it's basically Dan Ige fights every other weekend and loses, but other top featherweights just disappear for a while. Josh Emmett is, I think he's on a 4-fight winning streak now. Let me just check. Yeah, going back to 2019 when he knocked out Michael Johnson in a very weird fight where not a lot happened until he knocked him out. But then he knocked out Mirsad Bektik, had an incredible fight with Shane Burgos in June 2020, and then most recently beat Dan Ige in a fight where he walloped him a few times and dropped him, but, you know, it was a gritty, tough performance, like most Ige fights. There was a lot of Ige running in on a straight line, but then Josh Emmett is largely running in on a straight line with an overhand. So he's been coming up the slow way. Tapology has him at number 8, featherweight. UFC official rankings have him at number 7, but then I suppose they don't count the champion, do they? Because of why? I don't know why, but they... So he is technically number 8 in the world on the UFC rankings. Meanwhile, Keita is number 4 on the UFC rankings, coming off that win over Giga Chikadze, which, again, was awesome. We got into a debate about, like, fight of the year versus performance of the year or whatever, because it was a... I would watch that fight again and again. It was one of the most entertaining fights of the year, but not in like the fight of the year sense, not in the back and forth kind of way. He just beat the shit out of Giga Chikadze. And Giga Chikadze was coming off the heels of easily his best performance, that win over Edson Barboza. People started to think he was legit, and people weren't, you know, people were doubting whether Keita was legit because he took such an ass kicking against Max Holloway. I don't think there's ever been a bigger, you know, turnaround over the course of one fight or you know, two fights, because Keita looked like he didn't even belong in the ring with Holloway, and then he made Chikadze look like he didn't belong in the ring with him. It was just an absolute washout. I think I wrote about that performance because I loved it, the switch 45, the stuff like that, stepping off, changing stance so that Giga Chikadze was constantly going back and trying to walk Keita onto the body kick, which I refuse to call a Giga kick. So Keita just kept stepping off to the side, changing stances and coming in with his back to the kick. Worked a treat, jabbed him up, shot left and right straights all day, hit him with some nice elbows, knees, uppercuts, all sorts. Just an absolute beatdown. I think he took him down a couple of times, a good measure. The thing about Keita, like, yeah, he's got a lovely jab, nice boxing generally, but... I need to have a rewatch of that Max Holloway fight because I cannot remember the details of how Max Holloway put him on the back foot. But he does have a tendency to cover up quite a bit. If you can get him, if you can start pushing him back, he will put up double forearms. His footwork isn't the best. But his jab's really interesting because, you know, there's a lot of ways to throw the jab, as we always say. And really, we should probably just use add a qualifying word before it. But I love the way that his jab is almost disconnected from his body. Obviously not a pure punch in terms of getting body weight behind it and hurting people with it, but he can flick his jab from the shoulder and do it moving in any direction. He could be backing up, he can be circling out, and still snap an opponent's head back, bruise their eyes up, close their eyes. And those kind of jabs are a nightmare. And a lot of it is accuracy as well, because part of hurting people or, you know, punching people, not even hard enough, but punching people in a place that disrupts them enough as they're coming forwards while you're backing up. Tricky to do. And he does it over and over again with his jab. That fight with Burgos was an absolute treat. I mean, Burgos has had great fights with both these lads. It's interesting because when I look at these fights, I tend to look, you know, I tend to end up saying, like, I think a slower paced fight favors this fighter. I think this fighter probably wants to take the pace up. Because more than individual changes of style and tactics for an opponent, if you can just do the same thing you normally do, but by not engaging as much or engaging more than usual, you can make the fight better or worse for yourself, normally better. That's an easy fix. You just say, go after it more, or sit back, let him come to you, or whatever. In this one, I think, yeah, because Max Holloway put a crazy pace on Keita, and we talked about how, like, Keita does tend to cover up a bit too much. But Josh Emmett really does fight slow-paced fights and then try and catch you with one or two big ones. And he's a big moments fighter rather than like a beat-you-up-a-lot fighter. And of course, when you're going forward and putting more volume together, you're putting yourself in danger of getting counterpunched. But really, a lot of what Emmett does is just... He seems to catch people in breaks when they think he's not going to do anything and then burst across the floor very, very quickly. The Ige fight's a great example, but the Michael Johnson fight, it just sort of fell into the same pace. And then he goes, jab, skips his back foot up and comes in with an overhand, and then you're on the mat. I think the more you can stay on top of him, the less likely you are to lose sight or lose track of how dangerous he is. I think it's kind of like that circle off and then come back in banging we talked about the other day. Guys get into this I'm safe now mindset. And it's a thing that you do. Like, if you get good at any combat sport, you find times to take your breaks. I'm always telling this to people when they're like, you know, how can I improve my cardio for grappling or whatever? And I'm going like, my cardio is not great. I'm just, you know, resting when I'm on top. I'm resting when I'm in a butterfly half guard or something like that. You know, luxuries you don't have in MMA. You can't rest in butterfly half guard in MMA. But, you know, it's the same with boxing and kickboxing and things. You know when you're safe to circle off. You know when you're out in the open, you can drop your hands a bit, shake out the lactic acid. Or does lactic acid exist anymore? I swear people were like, that doesn't actually exist and it's a myth. And there was a whole like field of science about it. But yeah, you find places to take your breaks. And I feel like Josh Emmett tends to catch a lot of guys when they're taking their breaks. I think if Calvin Kattar stays in his face, I mean, it is a 5-rounder, so it's a long time to try and do that. Because Shane Burgos tried to get in his face and did a good job until he got clocked. And again, it was kind of a big moments fight for Emmett. It was Shane Burgos did a lot of good work, but then he'd get clubbed and really badly hurt. And it's not the case that like a big moment fighter in terms of you land one big punch around and then you fuck off and don't do anything else. You land one big punch, the other guy's got to survive, you're on top of them in like a front headlock or whatever. You know, there's a good 2 minutes of that round that you can win without really even landing another big blow, just because he'll be reeling from the first one, especially if you hit like Emmett. But one thing I took away from that Burgos-Emmett fight, Burgos kicked a lot more when he kicked, he did well, and that's something I'm always saying about Burgos, he should kick more. I've always liked Kattar's kicking. He just doesn't really go to it a lot. You know, he's this kickboxer with a great kickboxing pedigree under, is it Mark Della Grate? But he looked completely lost when Renato Moicano was counter low kicking him. And he doesn't throw very many kicks of his own. I think with a jab and a little teep, he could do a lot of good work. His takedown defense is pretty good. And Josh Emmett, very reluctant to take people down for the most part, even though he's known as a wrestler. He's definitely fallen into that trap where he's in love with his hands. But also, it's not even a trap, because if you're a wrestler and you can knock people out, you will definitely get to big fights and title shots sooner than if you're holding people down and boring everyone to tears. I'm going to be very interested to see if Kattar can stab him with the jab and start putting together some volume. How Josh Emmett reacts to that. I mean, he's got really pasty skin too, so he might swell up like a peach if you land a few good jabs on him. He looked good after the Burgos fight, and they both took lumps out of each other in that one. But yeah, this is a really compelling matchup, and it just reminds me that not enough happens in this featherweight division. I fucking love this featherweight division. Actually, while we're on the subject, before we move on, Zabit Magomed Sharipov handed his official retirement resignation into the UFC this week. Which is crazy. I mean, I've made a lot of fun out of Zabit because he was sort of he exploited that tendency in MMA fans to fall for razzle dazzle, and you know it's I complain about fighters who are too boring and get a ton of hype, but people immediately were saying this guy's going to be a future champion when he came in and had a fairly evenly matched fight on the feet with Brandon Davies, who was, you know, so-so. And I remember writing an article to piss people off that was like, Alexander Volkanovski, who I think had just had his second fight in the UFC, has far more potential of greatness than Zabit Magomed Sharipov. And sadly, that did turn out to be true. But it would have been more interesting if it turned out to be true and they'd fought and, you know, Zabit had faded in the third round like he always does, or second round even, end of the second round. It's kind of sad to see Zabit go out like this. But he had some health issues, and apparently he's now training to become a doctor. So that's honestly, you know, a net benefit to the world. We had more doctors than we had fighters. But yeah, mad respect to him. He must be a smart lad if he's able to train to become a doctor. Because they don't let you in and then go like try and keep up. They, you know, there's rigorous standards to do that. I always think of what Josh Barnett said about his parents when because he went into the first UFC at like 20. He's such a young guy in his first UFC fights. And his parents didn't want him fighting. And he said, they wanted him to go to college. And he said, I can go to college in a wheelchair. But I don't think you can get a medical degree if you've spent, you know, if you start at age 40 with CTE. So fair play to Zabit for, yeah, weighing things up. And the man spent his whole life doing martial arts. You know, I've been reading up on, is it the Five Principal Directions or something like that? It's this amazing wushu school in Dagestan where he trained, and I think Muslim Salakov. There was a couple, Magomed Magomedov. Like, there's basically everyone who's not a wrestler from Dagestan came through this amazing martial arts boarding school. So he's been, you know, he's had his life devoted to it, and he's still decided that he wants to be a doctor. And he was bloody fun. You know, he's going to be a fun one to bring up in a couple of years when people are like, unrealized potential. Because, yeah, he's going to be up there with Randleman and people like that. Well, I mean, Randleman won a world title, so. Zabit, definitely. Maybe even number one now. So rest of this card, we've got Donald Cerrone versus Joe Lozon. I think we talked about that before. Old man fight. Tim Means versus Kevin Holland could be fun. Kevin Holland down at 170 has been a laugh riot. His grappling looked really good in his last one. Who was that against? I think this was during my holiday, so I might have just skimmed it, but I do remember him looking good. And Tim Means, always fun. Great left straight, great elbows. Gonna be, I imagine he'll be on the shorter end of the reach and height in this one, which would be surreal, because Tim Means is the longer, taller guy in almost every fight he's had at welterweight. You got Joaquin Buckley versus Albert Duraev, and that's a take-no-prisoners matchup there. Duraev's very new in the UFC. He's had one fight in the UFC and one on the Contender Series, and he's all wrestling. You know, he's a Russian wrestler. And Joaquin Buckley is Mr. Fun Fights. You know, you could have him just in that sort of meme subdivision of welterweight and middleweight with guys knocking each other out in the first 30 seconds. You could keep that going forever, or until, you know, his brain's falling out his ears. It's an odd choice to put him against a guy who's probably not going to make a fun fight of it. You know, he might dominate him and finish him, but not in, you know, if he doesn't finish him, it's going to be a 3-round mauling, which probably won't be that fun. It'll just be one-way traffic. I just put up a clip from Duraev's Contender Series performance where he gets the Dagestani handcuff on a guy and his head is next to the guy's head and he's hammer-fisting him in the chin from about less than 6 inches out. It looks like he's wanking off a dick on this guy's face. And the whole booth, Bisping, Sanko, and whoever else is there, are going, oh, he might be finished here. And you're going, he's mildly annoyed by those, like, hammer fists to the jaw. He just can't block them. it's not going to knock him out. But the real one, the real fight for the real heads is Demir Ismagulov versus Guram Kutataladze. Yeah, crazy. I always think with these ones, like, guys who aren't super well-known and probably, even if they have good fights, aren't going to win over a ton of fans, the UFC could rent them out to people like Invicta and just have them as the main event of an Invicta card to get all the nerds in to watch the Invicta card. But, yeah, Ismagulov, these are the kind of guys, like, I don't like doing the whole ducking thing, but if I had a fighter, I'd be like, these fights are not worth taking. Maybe not Kutataladze, but Ismagulov is a guy who decisions everyone, is huge for the weight class, is good on the feet and on the ground, and, yeah, just a horrible matchup for most people. With nothing to be gained, because no one's going to watch Demir Ismagulov. Basically, anyone who sees you beat him is not going to know how important it is that you beat him. It's kind of like Ronaldo. Like, you're not going to, when he was on his streak, you're not going to get the respect that you should for beating him. Meanwhile, Kutataladze is another one who just, people won't know how fucking good this guy is, because he and Matheus Ganrot debuted against each other in the UFC. And Matheus had been KSW champion. He was a monster. I believe he was undefeated at the time. And Kutataladze looked amazing. He wrestled, he grappled up from the bottom, he landed good kicks and punches. He made Ganrot, who is a competent striker, like a decent striker actually, and good at hiding his takedowns in that, he made him into this, like, Sakuraba style, oh, I'm going to dive in from miles out wrestler. Made him look very predictable. But Ismagulov's coming off that fight against Rafael Alves last year, which was crazy. Rafael Alves, I kind of like him, even though he's a bit of a disaster. That was a fight where Alves would land a good shot or something like that and then jump on a guillotine and sit to the bottom position. And he lost 2 rounds jumping on guillotines. But then he also did that amazing Granby where he basically went into the Booker T spin-a-rooney to get off the bottom. The guy's a specimen. And additionally, he landed a couple of good body shots. Ismagulov had been in the middle portion of the fight, like after Alves's sort of explosive power had slowed down a little bit. In the middle of the fight, Ismagulov's slipping punches and jabbing this guy up, because Rafael Alves has had horrible trouble making weight. And Demir Ismagulov dwarfed him. So this guy must be fucking huge come fight time. But Ismagulov's jabbing him up in between combinations. He's dropped him with a left hook, a counter left hook. And then suddenly, a couple of good body shots land, and Ismagulov is slowing the fuck down. And it's only a 15-minute fight. Normally, that's not long enough for you to see people slow down significantly from body shots if they're in good condition. So I suspect that could be a bit of a weakness. And with Kutatladze's love of body kicks, that's, it's got some promise. But Kutatladze, you know, he's from the, is it All-Stars MMA in Sweden? He's a teammate of Gustafsson and Hamzat and Darren Till, I suppose. So hopefully he gets a little bit of hype off that, but you could see that they're taking wrestling seriously down there, because everything Gamrot did, he had an answer for. And Gamrot wasn't just like diving on doubles or anything. Gamrot's shooting, getting sprawled on, doing a sucker drag out of the sprawl. It was real chain wrestling and chain counter wrestling. That was one of the most impressive UFC debuts I've seen, to be honest, from Kutatladze. And I'd never seen him before that. He was in Brave CF, I believe, before that. But keep your eyes on this one. Couple of guys who I would definitely not want to fight as a lightweight, especially as a ranked lightweight. I'd be like, no, sorry, fuck off number 30 and number 23 or whatever you are. You got no business fighting me. Like, either of these guys, if you put them in the RDA, who's been sitting on that ranking forever, off beating Paul Felder preparing for a marathon, either of these guys could give RDA a horrible fight. What else we got? We got Julian Marquez versus Gregory Rodriguez, both meme fighters. I like the sound of that. Just gigantic middleweights, very bricked up. Very questionable that they're getting tested, but I like them both anyway. Adrian Yanez versus Tony Kelly, who most recently was complaining about being cancelled, but is here fighting a hot prospect and ready to jump into the top 20 of the division, I suppose, if he gets it done. But yeah, that's a good one. Who was Tony Kelly's last one? That was the one where he drove 23 hours across the country to go there. He beat Randy Costa. Yeah, well, Randy Costa, I mean, is Mr. Gas is out. Adrian Yanez had a lot of trouble with Randy Costa, but again, gassed him out. Yanez coming off the win over David Grant. Yeah, that fight's a lot of fun, if you ask me. Jeremiah Wells versus Court McGee. Ricardo Ramos is back against Danny Chavez, who I can't remember much about. Cody Stamen versus Eddie Wineland is... that's fun, because Cody Stamen's high pace, high volume, high grappling intensity sort of guy. Eddie Wineland, his chin was never his best asset, but definitely not in recent years. I'm interested. I mean, I just like watching Eddie Wineland fight because he's got such a weird style. I just don't like watching him get knocked out anymore. And then Kyle Dorcas, boy of the podcast, versus Roman Dolidze. Like it. And then the card is being begun, started, opened, whatever, by Phil Hawes versus Darren Wynn, which is peak meme fight at middleweight, because Darren Wynn will gas. He will hold on to people desperately when he gets them down, because he's so short he can't get people down most of the time. He can't get inside their range. And he's basically here because of DC privilege. And Phil Hawes is this amazing specimen who has no chin. So it should be a lot of fun. But I reckon that'll do us for today. Watch this card, pirate the match, or pay for the match if they'll let you. If there's some last minute change in that, I will absolutely pay for that fight. And on Sunday I'll either write about what was good from this card, the UFC card, or I'll write about the good stuff from the match, depending on what really gets my fight boner going. I'm your boy Jack Slack, you know where to find all my shit, and I will catch you on Monday. Cheers. Saying goodbye to MMA Lincoln Bless.